The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie, look what they're doing to me, trying to trip me up, trying to wear me down.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Eric Barker. Eric is the creator of the popular blog Barking Up the Wrong Tree, which presents science-based answers and expert insight in how to be awesome in life. His work has been mentioned in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, and Business Insider. His new book is also called Barking Up the Wrong Tree, and it was recently published by HarperCollins. Eric, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My wife and I just got back from the Aspen Ideas Festival, where we were leading a workshop, doing a presentation. It's on a new program that we've created with Caring Across Generations that's going to bring improv training to caregivers. Real cool. And there are four improvisational pillars that we were working with, and I want to give them to you because I think it ties into stuff you talk about in the book. And the first is the idea of using play to learn. The second is the importance of listening that is others-focused. The third is this idea around yes and, but coming from a place of creating agency in yourself and others. And finally, number four is about creating ensembles that can collaborate towards solutions rather than taking on the burden by ourselves. And I felt like you covered all of that in this book.
No, I mean, those are a lot of the key topics in terms of some of the things I talk about. I mean, especially, you know, play in terms of work, and, you know, listening in terms of connecting with others.
Yeah. And, you know, just talking about the premise of the book, you have a quote: much of what we've been told about the qualities that lead to to achievement is logical and earnest, but downright wrong.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the thing is, we always hear these maxims growing up about success. You know, nice guys finish last. It's not what you know, it's who you know. Winners never quit, quitters never win. And, you know, these are all very pithy, but, you know, I don't think any of them have really been tested or validated. And that was kind of the mission I took when writing the book, was basically to give these the Mythbusters treatment and to look at the academic research and talk to the experts and see if any of those maxims really held water.
So here's a good one. You talk about the research that Karen Arnold did from Boston College, where she followed 81 high school valedictorians from graduation onwards. So you assume this is the best and the brightest, right? They must be people who all end up becoming incredible leaders of organizations.
Yeah, pretty much not the case.
Okay.
You know, valedictorians do well. They do very well, but they don't end up changing the world or leading the world, because what makes people do well, especially in high school, is following the rules. You know, is school has very clear rules to be followed, and people who are very conscientious and follow those rules do well, whereas life is, you know, very messy and is not as clear. You know, there is no entrepreneur in high school. You kind of have to do what you're told. So valedictorians do well, but they don't become the people who lead the world or change the world. They become people who kind of follow the patterns that are already set.
Right. So what happens in our school system is, in many schools, we reward conformity. And then these outliers, these other people who don't fit into that, and maybe they're labeled in some way as bad or different, they end up becoming the rebels who then lead to real transformative change.
Absolutely. I mean, when you see the people who deviate significantly from the norm, you know, those results, those people don't tend to cluster in the middle, you know, of the bell curve. They're the extremes. Sometimes they do very badly, but sometimes they also do very, very well, because they actually, you know, try new things, try different things. They ask the questions you're not supposed to ask. And, you know, they're the ones who make big changes because they're not just blindly following.
Yeah. And continuing on this idea around leadership, you talk about something, and I'd never heard these terms before, filtered and unfiltered leaders. What does that mean? What are those two things?
That kind of ties in again with what you're talking about. This is research by Gautam Mukunda at Harvard Business School. And, you know, for a long time, the research on leaders was completely contradictory. Some research showed leaders didn't make a difference, and some research showed they made tremendous difference. And what Gautam's research showed was that's because there are two different kinds of leaders. Hmm. There are filtered leaders, and those are people who get strongly vetted by the system. And so if you're going to be CEO of GE, you know, that you have to climb the ladder. You have to do what you're told. Those people get strongly vetted. And so basically the results that you get with one of the top five versus another of the top five, they're basically going to be the same kind of person because they've all been run through the same filter. Versus unfiltered leaders are like your entrepreneurs, you know, and people who come outside the system. They haven't been filtered. They don't play by the standard rules. And so they produce tremendous change. Now, sometimes that change is negative, but other times, you know, you get leaders like Abraham Lincoln who come in and end slavery and do fantastic, you know, just rule-breaking things because they're not set on following the standard prescribed patterns.
That's interesting. And there's a pivot, too, that you talk about later in the book around extroverted leaders and introverted leaders that I thought was really fascinating because you have research that shows that both can be good, but it's not so much about their personality type. It is about the people that they are leading.
Absolutely. When you have people who are self-motivated, A players who know what they're doing, they know their jobs, and they're very motivated, introverted leaders are far superior because they say what they need and they get out of the way and they don't bother people. When you have people who aren't as motivated, who aren't as engaged, then extroverts are much more likely to play cheerleader and to get in there and, you know, get everybody rallied up and look over the shoulder and just make sure that everybody's doing their job. So, yeah, extroverts and introverts can both be great leaders. But the research, I believe it's from Adam Grant and Francesca Gino, show that it actually depends on who they're leading.
So I had to do some mental jiu-jitsu on this because I ran Second City for a little over 20 years. Obviously, well, I'm an extrovert and I led extroverts. And I'm like, I thought I was a pretty good leader. But then you also note in your research, one of the problems with extroverts is they don't listen. And I'm like, that's my thing. Actually, I do listen. And improvisation, you have to. It teaches you to listen all the way to ends of sentences and to be very, you know, sort of as an empathetic listener. But I do get the trait. I think for a lot of extroverts, you know, they're the ones who are going to be dominating the conversation, and that ain't going to work with other creative types.
No, I mean, you know, it's listening is critical for any kind of human connection. But extroverts can bring a lot of value, you know, when there isn't that energy, when there isn't that connection to get everybody talking, to just, you know, get that level of motivation that might not be there. You know, extroverts can provide tremendous value.
So I talk about that I needed to tell myself the story that I actually was a good leader. This is in your book, right? And this stuff is fascinating to me, just this whole topic. And I titled in my notes, The Stories We Tell Ourselves, because you know, quote, the brain doesn't like randomness. Meaning for the human mind comes in the form of the stories we tell ourselves about the world. And that plays out in a whole bunch of interesting ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, stories are really critical where, you know, this is where we see so much in terms of, you know, just when we look at the world, we always want to have a reason why things happen. You know, we don't like this idea that the world is completely out of our control and there's nothing we can do. And those stories, not only is our brain kind of wired for them, but they also provide tremendous value in terms of things like when you look at like grit and persistence. You know, when we have a story that we're telling ourselves that we were meant to do this, that this is our destiny, that I'm not the kind of person who gives up, that, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, there's this inevitability to it. It's aligned with our story. But when we tell ourselves different stories in terms of, well, I really shouldn't be here, I don't belong, then things start to feel futile. you know, we give up. And you see this in everywhere, you know, from even from like Navy SEAL training, because, you know, the physiological research shows that, you know, our brains and our willpower mentally give out a lot faster than our bodies do. And that story that we're telling ourselves, you know, allows us to keep going when things seem really difficult. We see that research, you know, Martin Seligman did research in terms of optimism and grit, you know, having a story that, you know, you believe things are going to work out. It's only intuitive that when you believe things are going to work out, hey, you give it another try, because it's going to. But when you have a pessimistic attitude, when you don't think things are going to work out, well, then it's futile. Why give it another shot? So those stories that we tell ourselves are really powerful, especially in terms of grit.
I was kind of blown away, too. Next week, we're having Kelly McGonigal from Stanford on the podcast, who's written about stress. And specifically, her research shows that if you approach stress positively, as if it's a good thing, that physiologically, your body will respond to stress in a more productive, better way.
Yeah, I mean, it's critical. You see so much of the research in terms of reframing. You know, very often, you know, we feel feelings in our body, and we don't necessarily know where they come from. Mm. And it's the stories and impressions that we assign to them. So sometimes, you know, you feel your heart rate go up, you feel goosebumps, and sometimes you're excited, sometimes you're scared. But, you know, it depends on that story you tell yourself. If you say that, you know, I'm excited about this challenge, then you're not overwhelmed. You know, your performance doesn't go down. But if you tell yourself, oh, I'm terrified, well, now all of a sudden your performance is going to drop, because the research shows that a little bit of stress, you know, really prepares us, gets us on edge, makes us perform at our best. And too much stress, you know, overwhelms us and reduces performance.
I liked when you referenced the David Brooks thing of resume values versus eulogy values, recognizing that the eulogy values are the more important ones for us.
I mean, absolutely. Everybody's always thinking about, you know, the resume values, where it's, you know, it's kind of like, am I going to be able to say, you know, hey, I'm going to put this on my resume. I did something really well. I had a great accomplishment. But those are very short term versus eulogy values. When you say to yourself, you know, what are people going to say about me when I die? What are people, what are the things that people are going to remember about me? You know, that gives us a much more long term focus, you know, in terms of who we want to be, not these little tiny achievements. You know, what kind of person do I want to be? What kind of person do I want to be remembered as? You know, that really brings the important values to the forefront and helps us make good decisions that will be valuable in the long term.
All right. So we're talking a lot about sort of individual motivation, the stories we tell ourselves. I'm going to assume that you are not going to be vacationing in Moldova anytime soon.
No.
And I don't think they're not going to want you there. So this is a country of people. And what you show us is this is an incredibly unhappy country.
Yeah. When they did, they did the research in terms of which countries were the least happiest. And the former Soviet state of Moldova came in dead last. And basically, Eric Weiner wrote about this, that it was basically because it's a black hole of selfishness. Basically, people don't trust one another. And without that trust, there's no way to develop, you know, social capital where we can rely on other people. It's gotten so bad that, you know, medical students bribe their teachers for grades. And that means that people are terrified to go to doctors under the age of 30 because they feel like they've bought their medical degree and don't know what they're doing.
Wow.
So just people do not, you know, work. People do not trust each other. They don't. And so you can't really create any scaling of value because people aren't working together, because everybody thinks everyone else is out to get them.
Wow. All right. So yeah, this is a place we don't want to go for obvious reasons, because we're not going to be successful there. And you have this idea in your book about choosing your pond wisely, and I love that phrase. And that is matching who you are with the place you need to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's something that I don't think it's emphasized enough, where, you know, if you are, you know, if you're the most creative person in the world, and you go to work for the greatest accounting firm there is. Those are two things that might be top tier, number one, and I don't think you're going to be very successful necessarily, because despite your tremendous skill set and the tremendous value that this company has in its arena, they're not well aligned. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of realizing what your signature strengths are, what your skills are, and then finding a place that respects and rewards those. When those get aligned, you know, that's where you can find great success.
This idea around know thyself, which is hugely important and cuts across all of the sort of behavioral science that we read, can get tricky when you really are very, very different. And you have a term in here, and I don't know who coined it, and maybe you did, which was hopeful monsters, which is a great phrase. That, like, it would be a great band name. But what are you talking about when you talk about hopeful monsters?
That's actually a term from biology, where mm-hmm. they used to believe that that all biological, you know, and genetic improvements were very small and incremental, and a theory was put forth, which was initially mocked, but now is believed to be quite accurate, that occasionally, you know, genetics makes a big jump, it makes mm-hmm. a big shot ahead, and sometimes it fails, sometimes it works out really well. But a hopeful monster is somebody who deviates significantly from the norm. And this is somebody, well, the example, one of the examples I use is Michael Phelps. If you look at the way Michael Phelps is built, mm-hmm. The swimmer, you know, basically his torso is too long.
Yep.
You know, his wingspan, his arms are way longer than they should be. He's got huge hands. And the truth is that these are very awkward proportions, but all an Olympic swim coach sees when they see proportions like that is gold medals, because the guy is basically designed to move in the water. And the funniest thing is that the thing that Michael Phelps is worst at is actually getting out of the blocks, because he was not designed to move on land. He is this extreme deviation from the physiological norm, but that actually makes him, you know, the person who has garnered the most Olympic gold of anyone ever.
Wow. All right. So let's say we know ourselves and we get ourselves in the right place. And the best job advice I ever got was like, I wanted to work in theater, and two different people said to me, then you need to work in a theater. Doesn't matter what you're doing. And I did that. So you have a great story here. And I think of people who end up at places like Harvard and MIT. And I didn't. I'm a big World War II buff, and I did not know the story about this sort of like unknown collaboration that became a known collaboration. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, basically, during World War II, the UK was getting bombarded by the Nazis, but they had something that they thought could turn the tide, and that was they developed a new form of radar, which used microwaves. What do you know? And they had this new form of radar. They didn't have the ability to build it because they were getting hammered by the Luftwaffe. So they collaborated with the United States, and MIT was going to develop this new form of radar that they could put in the planes and would turn the tide of the war. The only problem that MIT had was that it would just intermittently fail, just utterly fail, and they could not figure out why. And what it eventually turned out to be was that while MIT was working on this new form of radar, just across the Charles River, Harvard had a government contract to develop a new type of radar jamming technology. And so the two didn't realize it, but they were working at cross purposes. Mm-hmm. And finally, these two secret projects, someone was smart enough to let both sides know what was actually going on. And so this unknown rivalry became a known rivalry, and the two started actually working in concert, you know, Harvard trying to beat the radar and MIT mm-hmm. trying to beat the radar jamming. And basically, the two working together pushed both technologies through the roof, and we all know how World War II ended.
Wow, that's an amazing story. I love it, too, because, you know, we talk about in our work in improvisation the need to sort of embrace mistakes and find opportunities inside obstacles. And this is something that you find in your book. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting, and I've had a couple conversations with, I have a friend at Stanford who's writing a book on luck and people who are lucky. And you talk about that in your book in a couple different ways. And one of the ways is that lucky people just try stuff.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's research on luck, because some of us, when we think about luck, we think of, you know, total serendipity. But the truth is, there are certain things you can do to increase your luck. I mean, if you were to go inside your house, lock the door, never answer the phone, and never go outside, there's not too many wonderful good things that are going to happen to you, because you're just not being exposed to things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the first thing people can do to increase the chance of positive, of random positive things happening, is to get out there, to try stuff, to get exposed to people. When you look across the board, what you see is that people who are extroverted and optimistic are and who seek new opportunities are far more likely to be lucky. And again, it only serves it makes intuitive sense that if you're talking to more people, if you're trying more things, if you're optimistic and giving things a shot, that more good things are likely to happen to you.
Yeah, I have tremendous luck in finding parking spaces in cluttered downtown. And my wife was saying this to our friend Tina Stanford, was saying, you know, she thinks it's that Kelly just assumes he's always looking for the opportunity because he thinks it's in front of him. And so she just thinks I see it better because I'm looking for it. And I think there's an element of that. And you actually cite someone, and this also crosses over a recent conversation, this idea that faking it actually is a good tool. Fake it till you make it, that there's some science behind that being true.
I mean, you know, faking it, you know, can be, I mean, in terms of, you know, putting yourself out there, you know, trying new things, you know, giving yourself a shot, putting yourself in environments, because, you know, if you don't get out there and try things, how many more things are going to happen to you?
Yep.
Of course, you do have to be careful on the flip side that you're not lying or misrepresenting yourself, which can come back to bite you.
Yeah. You talk a little bit about failure, and that comes up a lot on the podcast because in improvisation, we use failure, like failure is our friend, and we bake it into our process, and it becomes a vital ingredient on the path towards the stuff that we create. And most businesses, I find, that is not a muscle that they want to flex. But you actually point out that it can be important in the creative process.
Oh, it's essential. The book I reference is Peter Sims' book, Little Bets, which basically he talks about, you know, the process that many creatives use, like, you know, Chris Rock and other comedians who go to open mic nights unannounced and try new jokes. And they mark the ones that work. They mark the ones that don't work. And it's just an iterative process. You know, that 1 hour HBO comedy special does not come out fully formed. It's tested, you know, over and over again, seeing what works, what doesn't. And the other analogy he uses, you know, that one of the few examples, you know, I agree with you. I think most companies aren't big on failure. Mm-hmm. But one area of business that is if you look at venture capital, where they do say they fully expect they're going to invest in 10 companies. 7 are going to be disasters. 2 are going to break even, and 1's going to be the next Facebook or Google.
Yeah.
And just, you know, if we implement something like that, where we use little bets, low resource, low investment, you know, things, just try a class, read a book, check out, and realize that 7 things aren't going to work out, 2 might be pretty good, and 1 is going to be that fantastic next opportunity.
Right. And again, the science also backs it up on this point, which is that most of the great work that we see come out is a matter of abundance. It's not that, you know, they painstakingly waited until they had the shiny idea and then just brought that forward. You know, the best composers wrote a lot of music and a lot of bad music to get to the good music. And we know that. We produce for any review that we're creating, which will end up with like 18 scenes, we've probably done 800. And we run through them fast. And so we failed quickly. We failed in context. We failed together to get all this work out to then pare it down to the stuff that really does work.
If you look across the board, everywhere from, you know, from scientific research papers straight out to the headlines of The Onion, what you see is that quantity creates quality.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the amount of, you know, people say, oh, my God, it's amazing how many masterpieces Picasso created. Yes, and if you look at the volume of things that Picasso created, you know, it's astounding. I mean, but, you know, the percentage stays roughly the same. And if you look at the same in terms of patents at the patent office produced, you know, who produces the most successful patents? Well, it's usually the people who produce the most, you know, the most possible inventions overall. So, yes, across the board in many areas, quantity leads to quality.
So, well, I'm curious, when did you go on this journey? At what point did you decide that you were going to sit down and start reading academic papers and books on a whole bunch of nerdy subjects that would then sort of match your, because you were a screenwriter, so you lived inside stories. But did this happen earlier in your career or later in your career?
It was later in my career. I've been a screenwriter in Hollywood for over a decade, or for Disney and Fox, and then I left Hollywood. I actually went to business school. I got an MBA, and I graduated right around the housing crisis. It was a terrible time. Yeah. So when did I start reading all these nerdy academic papers? Well, when I was unemployed and had plenty of time to sit around the house on the internet and read nerdy academic papers. And I mean, it was a time of questioning for me where I was looking for answers. And I had started, you know, my blog Barking Up the Wrong Tree, and I just started posting all of these interesting insights, you know, that I was seeing from these research papers. Mm-hmm. There's this great quote from William Gibson that I love, where he says the future is already here; it's just not evenly distributed. Hmm. You know, a lot of the answers that are going to lead to the great things we're going to see in the future, they're already here. It's just not everybody knows them. Many of them are stuck in the ivory towers of universities. So I started posting these things on the blog, and after about 5 years of doing that, people, my friends, have been saying to me, you know, you got to write a book, you got to write a book. Mm-hmm. And that was the next big step for me. And I decided to, having seen the research, what it showed and how it conflicted with a lot of what we believe every day, I decided to attack these maxims and myths of success.
You know, it's funny. So my journey is kind of the same with some reverse points. So I wrote a book. Yes, and with the guy who ran our corporate division at the time, around the improv principles and how they play out in businesses. And this is a subject matter I know really well. And then I do two things. And any author who says they don't do this is a liar. When you have a book out, you go to whatever bookstore you might pass and you look to see if your book is in the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We all do it. And I would go there and I'd see all these really cool other books in the business section that I started pulling out and reading. When I stepped down from running Second City, again, like that was a foolhardy. So I was semi-unemployed. They kept me on and paid my bills while I figured out what the hell I wanted to do. But I ended up in a random conversation, essentially random conversation, with the behavioral science group at the University of Chicago. And so a year later, one of the big projects I'm working on is just that, where we're partnering with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, as Richard Thaler's group, to study improvisation behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa. Because in improvisation, it is recreating human behavior. It's kind of a dream lab for these guys to have access to all these students. And then also recognizing we have the pedagogy of it, games and exercises that allow people to embody the insights we want them to have around things like focusing on another person, listening to them, collaborating in effective ways, creating, saying yes ands, you can create a bunch of abundant material. So it all sort of came together again, but through the same kind of accidental process that you had, because you found yourself out of work and you had time.
No, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't have had the time to do it otherwise. And I was in a position where I was looking for some answers. I was trying to figure some things out. And again, like we were talking about, you know, trying new things, trying little bets. You know, I started this crazy little blog, and I never thought it would grow into, you know, over 300,000 email subscribers and a book.
Wow. Yeah. But, you know, and the thing is, what I liked about your book so much is that you really do lean on the science to tell the story. You know, unfortunately, a thing that happens now is there's a lot of really great storytellers who figure out the science can abet their more interesting idea that usually is not true. And now hanging around with a bunch of scientists, nothing drives them more crazy than... And I'll say his name rhymes with Malcolm Radwell. and look, he is a great storyteller. There's no question. But you know, when you're an expert in a field and you look at it and you're like, well, that's not really what it says. So
no, that's definitely tricky when the storytelling overwhelms the science.
Yeah. All right. So this has been a fantastic conversation, and we always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. You kind of already gave us one, but I'm wondering if there's another time in your life which was maybe, you know, destined to be a no, but somehow turned into kind of a magic yes and.
I mean, I would definitely say for me it was the transition. I've been working on the transition from the book to the blog. I mean, I'm still doing the blog, but And everybody said to me, it's like, oh, you gotta do the book. It's like, oh my God, I'm spending so much time on this blog, and now I'm gonna undertake a huge book. It was like I was almost harking back to the screenwriting days, and
right.
And I was just like, I don't need another big huge project. This one's already gobbling up my time. And not only that, I had written comedy, in screenwriting,
mm-hmm.
and I was just like, I'm gonna have to take myself so seriously. It's gonna be a science book, and it's gonna be formal and I was like, you know what? No, they're right. I should do the book. The book's a good idea, but I want to have some fun. I want to mm-hmm. tell some crazy stories. I want to use my own voice. I don't want to use this formal, serious journalistic voice. So it was definitely. I felt a no. I did say yes, but I said, and I'm going to do it my way, my voice, my style.
Yeah, yeah. And that comes out. And I mean, and look, I've written a book. It's not easy. It is. and talk about abundance. I don't know about you. We threw away the first draft, probably 70% of it, and had to go back. It is a lot of work. It's producing a lot of words. There is a lot of self-doubt. But man, when you are getting to the end and it's the final footnote and you hit send, that's an amazing feeling.
Oh, there's nothing quite like it.
That's great. Eric Barker, the book is called Barking Up the Wrong Tree. Everyone should get it. Hey, thanks for coming on the show.
That was great. Thank you so much, Kelly.